Welcome to Women Who Move Nations, a podcast by the Public Transport Association, Australia, New Zealand. Each episode, we interview top female executives from the public transport sector in Australia, New Zealand, and around the world. If you're interested in leadership, workplace gender equality, or building clean, green transport for the future, this is the podcast for you. This season is proudly sponsored by NEC Smart Transport Solutions. Find out more at nec.com.au. Now here's your host, Michelle Batsis.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our next episode of Women Who Move Nations. I'm really excited today to be interviewing our special guest, Kylie Gorham, who is a Senior Product Manager at NEC. Welcome, Kylie.
Well, thank you so much, Michelle. I'm really pleased to join you today as well.
Awesome. So I've got a range of things that I want to talk to you about today and hear from you. And I think what I'm super excited about is this nexus between transport and technology. And we know that there's just such rapid technological advancements that are completely disrupting our industry in terms of how we plan and deliver our transport services. So really keen to unpack that. And I do know you're a super huge fan of public transport as well. So just delighted to have this convo. All right, so we're going to get started. If you could please share with our listeners an overview of your role and like what are your priorities that you're focused on at NEC?
So first of all, to give a little bit of a framework to that, I'm part of NEC's smart transport team. So that team is focused on delivering what we call our mobility platform. And that platform is comprised of several pillars that are designed to create a complete opportunity for transportation organizations to have tools and capabilities to help them deliver their services with excellence. So in one part, that would include, for example, what we call our operational intelligence pillar, where by virtue of the access we have to such a large amount of data that's collected through automated systems in public transportation now, we're able to use that information, analyze it, use it to inform strategic decisions and provide that information back to our transportation customers so that they can deliver better services. So that's one pillar. Another area that's really, you know, quite dear to my heart is safety and security when you're using transportation services. Those safety and security measures need to not only be for the passengers, you know, we always and often talk about the safety of passengers and encouraging them to use public transportation and feel safe when they're doing them, but also safety for the operators themselves, making sure that all of those people who are delivering that service can do so feeling really comfortable in their environment. Ticketing solutions is another part of our platform, and that's actually the area I'm mostly responsible for, making sure that our ticketing solutions not only effective, safe and secure with respect to privacy of people's personal information and their financial transactions, but also looking for ways to make the solution more accessible to people so that, you know, all people with all sorts of different kinds of economic backgrounds, preferences for technology and so on, can use those systems to pay for their public transportation journeys. And the last one is we focus very much on those parts of our platform that deliver out to the customers themselves, the passengers. So that's our mobility apps that deliver real-time information and those types of important information streams that encourage people to use public transportation because they feel really confident that that bus is going to be there when they get to their stop and they're not going to miss it. That's what we actually deliver. And my role in that as a product manager, so I'm responsible to identify what our customers need, what the market is indicating to us our solution should support, and to kind of develop a vision for how our platform should move forward. And then I work with our team, our incredible team of very, very capable engineers and other personnel, and they sort of turn that vision into a reality. You know, the overall consequence of that is a better public transportation experience, which means more people are going to be on public transportation, which is the goal we have.
Yeah, excellent. I mean, that's just music to my ears, really. And I think our listeners know I'm such a huge advocate for public transport. And when we're talking about safety, security, and accessibility, like we need such a focus on this. So as you mentioned earlier, you're a real fan of public transport. There's something driving you in terms of how you've entered this sector. Let's unpack that a little bit for our listeners, because I understand you have a background in engineering and IT, which is great. And I wonder actually when you did that, how many people were doing engineering and IT, right? But how did you make this decision to pursue a career in transport?
Well, you know, I really didn't. I didn't choose public transportation. Mm. It kind of chose me. In the early part of my career, I worked predominantly in mining and construction. I mean, I'm from Western Australia. That's the biggest part of our economy. But what happens in mining environments, the commodity prices drop and investment in mining drops for a little while because those commodity prices are down. And I sought a different role for a period of time. And I found myself, funnily enough, I was in an interview with a transportation solutions provider, and they left me with a specification document for a driver's console unit, you know, the device that the driver actually sees that tells them how to turn. And back then, those devices also accepted payments at that time as well. And I was left with this document for about 20 minutes and asked to read it and be ready to answer questions. Well, this poor interviewer came back in after 20 minutes and I've got this document with bits crossed out and write-ups all over it and sticky notes saying, this needs to be improved. This is a poor customer experience, you know. And I just absolutely loved the topic. And I think it was pretty obvious right then that this was where I needed to be. I was not only going to really enjoy it, but it really felt like I had a lot to contribute. So I kind of fell into public transportation as a consequence, and I'm so glad for it.
Well, I think we're all glad for it because I can really hear your passion. And so at that point, when you had that exposure, is that really then what led you to the technology discipline specifically? Because, you know, I hear that you were doing mining. You know, could you share with your listeners, you know, how this exposure to technology has really aligned with your belief and passion for public transport?
Oh, definitely. I can say that for years, my family and friends have sort of challenged me over this nerdy obsession for technology in public transportation. And I remember an early discussion with my mother. She said to me, but why are you so excited about it? And I said to her, well, you know, you might walk up to the railway gate at the station and you tap your card on the reader and the gate opens. And that's the only thing that you really know. That's a very limited exposure to what's going on. But I sort of ran through with her, you know, the card and the reader talk to one another. They decide if they're allowed to share information. Information gets written to the card and, you know, they check to make sure you're allowed to travel. And then they open the gate. And she said, well, that's still not very exciting. And I said, but it all happens in 200 milliseconds. That's the challenge that people who work in our sector have all the time. So many really small steps need to happen in the right order for the process that they are managing and designing for to be really effective and really safe, but also really fast, because keeping people moving through is the most important part.
So, Kylie, I wanted to ask you another question about your career before we start looking more around public transport and unpacking that a little bit too. So, one of my favorite questions to ask is, what are those moments that you've been really proud of? And so, I could ask you, perhaps to look back over your career, what are some of those milestones or what are those projects that you've been particularly proud of?
Yeah, look, I can actually say this is a little bit easy for me to answer. And that's because there's one particular milestone, and it would be the earliest milestone for me in working in public transportation and service delivery to transit agencies. It persists today as still my proudest. I've certainly had some other milestones since, but I was really fortunate to join the same organisation where I read and completely destroyed, unfortunately, their specification document. But that led me to leading a team to deliver an uplift in the ticketing system in Stockholm in Sweden. They had magnetic stripe paper tickets. And, you know, the uplift was to lift their solution up to have closed-loop smart cards. And I was still, you know, very young and obviously still very new to transit at that time. And the customer and my leadership in my organisation and particularly some of my more senior peers, they really put their faith in me to lead, you know, for me as a fairly young and new leader of a team, a fairly large team, really young and enthusiastic engineers. Some of them were graduates and really newly out of university. And I had the opportunity to lead that team to deliver that solution for Stockholm. And we did it. And I will say that it was quite a strain on me personally. It was such a busy time and such a lot of responsibility that came on me in such a short amount of time. But that was actually also really a great growth experience for me, both personally and professionally. And I developed a lot of resilience through it. So the reason that I'm proud of that is not only that I, you know, the team and myself, we delivered the outcome that we were aiming for, but we did it in a way that everybody was very happy in their working environment. It was a young group of people who really were benefiting from being challenged and then also mentored. And at the end of it, even though I was a bit worn out, I have to admit, I'd also grown as a person and felt more confident to then go on to my next roles after that.
I loved hearing that story. Kylie, I really appreciate you sharing this, and your passion just comes across so much. And if we talk a little bit more about public transport and your experience in that, something I heard you say earlier was around the concept of passenger or customer confidence. And I think this is a really interesting concept to explore more because, you know, we know that we want public transport to be an attractive choice for everyone. And we also know that there are people where public transport might be their only choice. And certainly when we look at the diversity of our community, there is a proportion of people who aren't so familiar with technology. They might not have the smartphone yet, but they still need to be using our network. And actually, we know that technology and data is really powering our networks now. And so I wanted to ask your thoughts around, you know, how do we encourage passenger confidence for all people, for everyone, including those who might not be so familiar or comfortable or have that background in technology?
Yeah, it is a really good point. And for me, ensuring that we meet the needs of a diverse range of passengers is one of the most important parts of my role. To give you an example, you know, not everyone feels confident to use a smartphone, and not everyone has one either. But I think, you know, particularly here in Australia, we do find that there's a pretty good penetration of people who do have them, but they don't necessarily feel really confident with apps and the information. A lot of people turn off notifications because they worry about whether that notification is coming from somewhere safe and so on. So, you know, for all the people who feel really comfortable with their smartphone, they can look at their phone and see what the next arrival time is for the train that they want to catch. But we always have to make sure that there are other options for other people. And some of those include, for example, obviously there's signage at platforms. We can have signage at individual bus stops that, you know, counts down to the arrival of the next bus. We also need to include things like text-to-speech buttons so that when people who can see a display, but for those people who have a vision impairment, they can press the button and hear what's on the display being read out to them as an example. Even making sure that for those who do have a phone, if they don't feel like using an app, and looking at the notifications, using SMS to still send them the same sort of information, or having a telephone number with an interactive voice recognition service so that they can call and they can say, well, you know, this is the route or the service number that I want to travel on, and they get back to them read out schedule information automatically by that service. So those are the sorts of things. It's never one channel that we need to deliver our information out. We need to think about the limitations of whatever we might think is, you know, the best or the newest technology channel, but think about what the disadvantages are in that channel and make sure we cover them off in some alternative channels so that everybody's needs are met.
That's such a good point, Kylie. Like, as you were talking, I was thinking about my mum who has an iPhone, but I mean, certainly she wouldn't be going into an app and setting up notifications, right? So this concept around having a channel that suits the needs of all passengers actually is such a great concept. Yeah, as you're talking, you know, because I'm thinking around, you know, technology and obviously NEC is really at the forefront of how you, I guess, accelerate the adoption of technology. And I mean, and what we know, I'm presuming that, you know, your clients and your stakeholders, there are challenges in around how quickly we can adopt new technology. And I mean, given the rapid pace of advancements that, you know, we're seeing, you know, I mean, I was reading something around the exponential kind of growth of technology kind of doubles every 5 years, which is just crazy. And so I mean, how are you advising and how are you educating your clients around adopting the technology? How do they deploy it? How do they operationalize it? You know, given the length of time it normally takes to implement a new solution.
It's definitely a challenge for them. And I think for our government partners and the stakeholders that we engage with as our customers here, they have an added problem too. They bring with them a real responsibility for the expenditure, and they're really looking to make sure that they don't leave the completion of their procurement exercise at a point where it also can't grow. And in this regard, we've seen a real growth of a changing model, a changing contracting model for solutions and services in the transportation space. So software as a service is what we call it. And I think, you know, we can all go back to the days when you used to get a new home computer and you'd get a box set for Microsoft Office and a CD and you'd install it on your computer. And it was just there just for you. And at the time you bought it, whatever were the features and capabilities in Microsoft Office on that particular day, that was what you had. And the only way to extend that in the future was to actually go out and get the latest version at a later time, basically go through your procurement again. Now, in the same way, we have a situation where traditionally public transportation technology solutions have been delivered like that, one by one, almost like metaphorically, they've got the CD set for their transportation solution and they've installed it on their servers and they've implemented it at a certain date, but its ability to grow has some limitations as a consequence. So software as a service modeling takes some of the pressure off those stakeholders to be, you know, absolutely perfect when they go through their procurements for new technology. They don't have to be 100% sure that they've included everything that they might possibly need for the next 10 to 15 years. And we have a model for delivery of that service that it can grow as their passenger counts grow, as their passenger needs grow. And that also includes accessing new technology as it becomes available. You know, sort of we take a view of looking to make sure that those more fixed parts of a solution, like the devices that you put on the bus or on the train platform, for example, that they have really good longevity in them and are able to cope with increasing utilization into the future of more complex functions. And then the model around the software piece is designed to allow the agency to come back and say, I want to just change my subscription a bit. I'd like to have this new feature that you've now got available. We think that's going to benefit our customers. And they don't have to go through a whole new implementation to achieve that.
So good, I think, to just think about the flexibility around deployment as well and what you're sharing about a different kind of approach in terms of how you work with government agencies in relation to rolling out technology and systems. I was just thinking before, just around, you've spoken about all of the different kind of innovations that you've worked on or been a part of, but I have no doubt in your role, you're looking at what's coming down the pipeline. And I just wanted to ask you, you know, if you kind of look out on the horizon or crystal ball, you know, what do you see as the one game changer? Like if you could pick anything in terms of a trend or, you know, what you see on the horizon, what do you see that to be?
So there's definitely some great opportunities for us in that safety and security space. There's going to be a few challenges for people around some of the concepts of these changes because they challenge some of our perceptions around privacy and security. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, I'm really pleased to be working with the team I'm working with at NEC, because even though we're looking at promoting some new technologies that people might find a bit challenging, we're doing the groundwork too to make sure that they are secure and people's privacy is really well respected and protected. But one of those areas is to utilize the combination of video surveillance information and artificial intelligence capabilities. Now, there's a lot of camera information available. We get a lot of video feeds. This is infrastructure that already exists in a lot of places. A lot of public transportation infrastructure already has, you know, CCTV, for example. And then when we think about making the environment safer for the people who work in public transportation, customer service officers, you know, transit officers or inspectors and so on, giving them the opportunity to say, for example, have a body camera. One, it allows for them to video what's going on, and that information can be used for a couple of purposes, but it also creates a confidence for them. Most people who are you know, looking to be a little bit antisocial, if they know they're going to be filmed, they might take it back a few levels, and that creates a safer environment for those customer service people. But that information that's being captured on the video, when centralized and in near to real time and has an AI algorithm passed over it that can detect things like subtle changes in the way people move, their stance, their facial expression, can be an indicator that something might be brewing that might not be ideal in a public environment. And what you have is an opportunity, because it's in near real time, is for the transit service people, you know, the customer service people or the transit police or inspectors, to have an early notification that they might want to intervene and avoid something unpleasant happening. Or even if they're not able to intervene before it starts, they're already on the run to resolve it and to create a safe environment for everybody who may otherwise be affected. So, you know, we're always looking to make sure that the barriers that prevent people from being confident to use public transportation are broken down. And confidence from a security and safety perspective is definitely one of those. And people, I think, would be surprised to know that there's a whole heap of technologies and solutions and services happening in the background that they don't really even have visibility of, that are just naturally creating a calmer and safer environment on a day-to-day basis.
PTA ANZ is proud to bring you Season 7 of the Women Who Move Nations Public Transport Podcast in partnership with NEC Australia. With over a century of innovation and a strong commitment to creating a brighter, more inclusive world, NEC is dedicated to gender equality and diverse perspectives, and is amplifying the voices of women leaders in public transport. Struggling to hold on to your drivers? Transform your bus operations with NEC's Turn by Turn, the first bus navigation system built to reduce driver onboarding and training significantly. Head to nec.com.au/STS.
Yeah, thanks for sharing on that point, particularly when you're talking about AI and security. I mean, I think these are issues now that are affecting every sector, but certainly become a real priority in transportation. Yes. I've heard you just talk about so many different innovations and technology solutions in regards to transport. And I just thought I might ask you, you know, is there anything else that you've witnessed or been a part of during your career that would be worthwhile sharing with the listeners?
There was a really pivotal moment for me. I was working within an organization on real-time passenger information solutions. For many of us, this has become almost like a normal thing, that you have information that tells you when the bus is arriving on time, and, you know, right down to knowing how many bike racks on the bus are available, and, you know, are all of the spaces for wheelchairs already taken, or is there capacity, and so on. We've become really used to that information being available to us pretty easily. But there was a real moment for me when I started working in that area early on, where somebody sort of said to me, you know, this is why the work we do is important. And, you know, I'm a little bit of a softie in some ways, and the human impacts of what I do every day, they're really, really very real to me. And the comment that was made to me was, you know, our work is so essential. Can you imagine if we don't deliver accurate and frequent real-time updates, the person who misses their bus, well, they might be late for an interview and not get to that job. They might not get that job that could change their life. They might miss the chance to sit next to someone and chat to them on the bus. That person could have become the most important person in their life. Or it could be that someone is on a bus to go somewhere and see someone special to them for the very last time ever, and they miss it. And, you know, those human aspects of the work we do, you know, we joke, everyone jokes. Kylie says she's a transit nerd, and I am a transit nerd. I love the technology, but I come from a family of people who are very heavily involved in providing direct benefit to other people, nurses, paramedics, teachers, people who work with troubled youth. I don't help people in such a direct way every day, but I can say for myself, hand on heart, that the work that I do delivers benefits to millions of people every day, and that's my way of giving back. I'm not the teacher, I'm not the paramedic like my brother is, but I'm definitely able to deliver a value to people. And it's that intersection between technology and the human element that we need to keep looking for and providing for, and that's the focus of our team.
I'm really touched with what you've shared, Kylie. It just got me thinking about so many things. And, you know, actually I recall being on a bus in London, which, you know, is a transport network that we all, you know, look up to.
And, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And I caught a bus that was supposed to be 16 minutes to get my connection to then go to the airport, and the bus took 50 minutes and the stress was real, right? And
yeah,
public transport real-time information is just so key to my heart. And you were talking about some innovations there around, you know, understanding the capacity or is there space for a wheelchair. Let's be real. I haven't been to many jurisdictions where I'm seeing that. So I actually think it's really important that we're thinking about these things because, you know, for the people planning and delivering services, obviously they're thinking about customer information, but there's so many nuances. And as you would know, only technology can really get us to that point where we're able to provide that information. So yeah, thanks for sharing on that answer. I honestly got some goosebumps. So I do, like, I really love hearing your passion. I'm going to change a bit of direction because, as you know, this is a women in leadership podcast and really about raising the profile of women, but also inspiring others in terms of their career and their leadership. So I want to ask you some questions about leadership. Okay, first of all, how would you describe your leadership style and how has that evolved over the years?
It's a good question. I think one of the things that I'm most commonly known for is I'm a decision taker. I'm also a complete tennis tragic. So let's be clear, I love my tennis. And I play a serve and volley style of game. And so too does John McEnroe, of course. He does it far better than I do. But, you know, I read his biography and he talked about having a mantra in his mind when he was playing, which was, you know, move forward, move forward, move forward, move forward on the court, which you need to do when you play that style of game. And he spoke in his biography about how after his tennis career had ended in terms of competition, you know, he continued to apply that in his mind, always be moving forward. And from a leadership perspective, it's so important to enable your team and your colleagues to move forward. And when you're responsible for taking the decisions and setting the direction, you need to do it in a really timely way. So, you know, from a leadership style perspective, that's certainly one aspect that I've often had feedback that it's appreciated. And honestly, the anxiety that people have when they're not sure where to go is so much worse than even making a bad decision. So being decisive is important and keeping everyone moving forward is a really essential responsibility for anyone in leadership. In terms of evolution, though, I'll say this, you know, these days, I try and be a little calmer. I think that, you know, when you're really early in your career, you feel a real pressure to always be seen to be doing things and to making decisions quickly, almost as if making a decision quickly means that you were absolutely on top of it and you knew everything and it was unequivocal and you must be right, as opposed to the perception that if you take a little bit of extra time, it suggests some sort of weakness, like being unsure. And I think that by contrast, it means that you're actually making sure that your decision is going to be good for everyone and you're not going to have to pivot again at another point in time. So the balance between the two is really important. And I do feel that as my career has progressed and, you know, perhaps painfully, I've sometimes seen the negative outcomes from making a decision too quickly. Taking a little bit of extra time, particularly for decisions that you know have a really high risk impact, make the decision for sure, but be cautious to make it in the right sort of time window for how risky it is.
I love what you've shared there, both in terms of the decision taking and how you approach that, but also this movement going forward. And hey, I'm a huge tennis nut, right? So I was just so excited with what you were talking about. And, you know, thinking through when you're talking about a serve and volley game, you know, we don't actually see that anymore, right? Everyone's a baseliner. And this idea, though, I think, where this metaphor around moving forward and how important that is fantastic. Okay, I want to ask you about influencing and, you know, in your leadership, in the industry, and, you know, I can just hear how much you kind of know and what you're identifying in terms of possibilities as well. So, you know, I think a big part of leadership is around the ability to influence, to bring attention to the issues, to really kind of cut through the noise. And, you know, there are obviously a lot of challenges that we see in public transport, both in planning and delivering, you know, things like ghost buses, driver shortages, you know, which is really resonating, you know, around the world at the moment, particularly around planning, delivering bus networks. They're just some examples. And I wanted to ask you, you know, how do you bring attention to the challenges, you know, to the priority challenges, and influence the sector to address them?
Great question, and really an answer in two parts. The driver shortages and the ghost buses, you know, they are symptoms of, you know, sometimes problems within the transportation system and the technology it uses, for example, with the ghost buses. And with driver shortages, you know, that's symptomatic of, you know, a wider problem, but could possibly have a technology solution. But there's actually a deeper issue here. There's a deeper challenge for public transportation here, and that is the changing patterns that we're seeing in mobility. What we're seeing is that people are increasing their use of other mobility options other than their private vehicles. It's not necessarily a case that they're choosing public transport. It's more a case that they're choosing not to use private vehicles. And there are a few drivers for that. Some of them are personal. Some of them are, for example, cost of living pressures. We're particularly seeing young people are not getting their driver's license and or not buying their own private vehicle. And some of them are continuing to live at home for longer so that they've got a family pool of cars to use. Also, too, there's a bit of a desire and particularly younger generations to preference taking public transportation because they kind of get a little bit of time back. And they use that time when they're in transit to read or to catch up on social media. Some people are choosing public transportation just to avoid the stress of congestion when they're driving themselves. And a couple of other drivers are societal. We obviously always talking about our desire to reduce the impact of any type of journey we take on the environment. And one of the things about taking public transportation as opposed to driving yourself, we actually do see a benefit through statistics that there's a reduced risk of injury or death because there's just less vehicles on the road and less risk. But it doesn't really matter which of those things are the motivator. Really, the shift we need to have and the challenge that we need to address is we need to address what is our priority in decision-making about investments in transportation infrastructure. You know, we've had a love affair with the car, you know, Ford versus Holden rivalry notwithstanding, for a very long time. And historically, our policy decisions and our capital investment decisions have been focused on enabling people to get to where they need to be in their private vehicle. But with these emerging mobility trends, we really need to have a little bit more scrutiny on how we pay for transport infrastructure. And that's not just public transportation. That's all of the levies and taxes through state and federal government that contribute towards like a pool of contribution that is meant to be intended for transportation infrastructure, but maybe isn't always being used that way. And we need to reconsider if that historical investment pattern and decision-making process is the right one for us going forward.
Just so fascinating, Kylie, listening to you talk about all of these issues that are really, I think, just so critical, aren't they, to the industry and your ability to kind of focus on that and lead on those issues as well. So in terms of leadership, I now kind of want to change the conversation to talk about women in leadership. And mm-hmm. as we know, there is absolutely a gap in terms of women's representation in leadership roles in transport. The last stats I looked at, about, you know, 20% women in senior transport roles in Australia. I have no doubt that those kind of statistics are reflected in different countries and cities around the world. I don't have the stats in hand, though, around women in tech, but I tell you, like, I have no doubt that, you know, it would be similar in terms of the gender gap that we see in leadership roles. So let's start with your own experience in this. We know it's traditionally a male-dominated sector. Now, I want to recognize that there's absolutely improvement, but also we are really seeing that cities and countries are also seeing a bit of a backwards trend as well. It's like two steps forward, one step back. What has been your personal experience of being a woman, of being a leader in this traditionally male-dominated field?
Yeah, I also agree that there's been, you know, the to and fro is certainly happening. We have a period of time where there's a real intense focus on improving the balance of diversity, particularly on a gender basis in across many industries. And we have a little bit of a forward movement and then we do resile back. But, you know, I come at this, perhaps I'm a little bit older as well. And in one sense, there was not a lot of expectation in my generation that, you know, we would have great representation in traditionally male-dominated environments. And yet I went into one and have continued and always worked in what are considered more male-dominated environments. And I've been very fortunate. I haven't had, you know, any sort of experience that has made me question my choices or feel that I'm limited in any way. And I think that I've been very lucky too. I've often worked for larger organisations that have good practices and policies around that. And I think that that's one of the things that we need to always be constantly reviewing in any kind of business is, you know, are the things that we have every day, the practices and processes that we're following, do they continue to be enforced and implemented? And, you know, or do we take the foot off the gas, if you like, and forget? And that's one of the reasons that we're falling back. So making sure that those things are in place, it's a leadership responsibility, and then, you know, everyone benefits from it. I also do think that there's definitely more women in senior and leading roles in transportation today than there were 20 years ago, you know, when I first fell in love with working in transit. And those women are not only leading organisations such as mine. I mean, ultimately, my boss is a woman as well. You know, they're also within the public transportation sector as well. We're starting to see women leading the PTAs themselves and, you know, seeing, you know, women in the seat as the most responsible or the most senior executive for transportation departments in government and at state and federal levels. So I think that that opportunity is there and it demonstrates that we're embracing it. We would continue to either be stagnant or fall back a lot in those most senior levels if those women weren't able to progress or if they were being particularly buffeted. We need to consider how we bridge the gap between those who enter at the entry level, at the early start of their career, and bring them up through. And I will say that mentoring women in the workplace environment to encourage that, it's not only the responsibility of other women. And I'm really pleased to say that I've found throughout my career that the men that I work with, as much as the women, mentor everyone, but often with a view to recognizing that there's a potential gap in the confidence and the opportunity recognition for women, and they go the extra mile. We've just got to keep doing that and make sure that the women who are coming through can continue to see that there's a next level that they can get to and that they are just as entitled to be there as everybody else.
Absolutely. I mean, Kylie, I think you've landed on something too, which is really important, right? Because sometimes people talk about, I think, you know, it's on the woman, you know, mm-hmm. it's kind of on the woman to change that, to step up. And obviously I think there's just so many factors because obviously there's systemic ones as well. But let's just delve a bit more into mentorship because I think it's important we talk about this. So personally for you, are there women that you look up to professionally or have been mentored or inspired by?
Well, there's one real standout, and I'm afraid to say it's not a person who's worked in transportation, but I would probably bring this up because I think about Diana Warnock all the time. So, you know, I'm from Perth, Western Australia, and in the late 1990s, you know, into the 2000s, I lived right in the middle of our central business district. It was pretty rare to live there then. And I was involved on a number of committees and recommending organisations around safety and security and so on in the city. And I got to know a number of local politicians, state government representatives and so on. And I got to know Diana Warnock during that time. She was a member in the Legislative Assembly in Western Australia. She was the state government member for Perth. And she was just an absolute firebrand of energy across the arts and women's health and wellbeing and for people who are disadvantaged. And her influence on me was with respect to confidence. I think one of the reasons that I have not felt discomforted in the workplace, particularly a male-dominated workplace as a woman, it's because, you know, I just don't subscribe to the idea that because I'm a woman, that should factor into any of the assessment of my abilities or my opportunities. And by not subscribing to it, no one else around me subscribes to it either. And I think that that really can engender quite a passive but positive outcome for other women in the workplace as well. Now, if it's never questioned and never discussed, that's not a good thing. Obviously, it needs to be. But if there's also a confidence to say, I'm not going to entertain the idea that this is a factor in whether or not I have an opportunity, that just quiet confidence is also you know, takes us forward a little bit. And a lot of that confidence that I have comes from the example that I saw in all these committee meetings I was in with Diana, because she just, as I say, total firebrand, right on it all the time, and just took over, never a question. So that's definitely one. And I would also say that, you know, in recent years, I've been really fortunate to be part of a transportation solutions team, you know, that actually comprised more women than men, a technology delivery team, quite against the grain. And it was led by a female general manager, Bonnie Crawford. And, you know, I watched Bonnie over the last few years encourage the participation of women broadly within our group, advocating for them, you know, in the workplace, being considerate of the particular sensitivities of women, but not in an overboard way. She always led the team with a great deal of consideration and humility and encouragement. But what really impressed me was she needed to be steely in a conversation to advocate for the outcomes that were needed. She did it in a way that still ensured that people felt like they were coming with her, and so they were invested. And it was that example, and I've seen it often with women in leadership roles, that there's some kind of element of softness or humility that they can bring to even the most robust discussions. And it's actually something that I keep in my mind all the time. When I'm faced with a robust discussion, and particularly as a woman, I try to go into those discussions with a real calmness and, you know, firm but calm, look for the moment of empathy, consider the impact on other people if they're in a robust conversation. And you bring this sort of a little bit of softness and humility that I think sometimes women carry a little bit more naturally, and it can lead to a really good outcome of even the most difficult conversations.
I love hearing your perspectives on this issue, Kylie. And sounds like Diana, a very inspiring woman. I've not heard her name, but I love that you've shared your story and experience about knowing her and working with her. You were talking a lot about this diversity, and I just wanted to ask you, I mean, recognizing this is a women in transport, absolutely inclusive of gender diverse people, but, you know, we know that there's other diversity gaps, right? And whether that's cultural, whether that's about neurodiversity, whether that's about age, mobility, there's so many aspects, right? I think of, as leaders, how do we really reflect the diversity of the communities we serve? And so just wanted to ask you, in terms of other diversity gaps in public transport leadership, are there any other ideas or views that you have around how we can support and encourage more diversity in the industry?
I think one of the feelings that I come away from discussions around diversity and accessibility, you know, the two are a little bit related to one another, in order to make sure our solution is really accessible, we need a diverse range of inputs to inform technology and solutions that really can cater for every scenario and every individual type of person's needs. And one of the things that does happen is we almost compartmentalize the different types of needs that people bring to that diverse discussion in order to inform what is a really well-rounded service. And I mean, I remember being a small child and getting on the bus to go to school. It was the 143 I used to catch down South Street, and the bus had really tall steps, and every bus had steps at the front door then. And, you know, all buses now have ramps, and they you know, they can be hydraulically lowered to meet the curb and so on. And this is an accessible improvement that has mostly come about in terms of trying to address a need for people who use wheelchairs. But it has benefits for so many more groups of people, seniors, people with prams. I mean, you know, I've preferred it at times. People can have a short-term injury that means that they benefit it. And so I think it's really important that we don't compartmentalize all the different groups when we talk about, you know, making sure that we cover off on diversity and treating each individual diverse grouping or cohort as if it's special within itself. They are, but it's the collective that's really important, because often addressing a need of one particular group often indirectly benefits everyone else as well. And it really lifts the floor of what the total service or total solution is at that point in time. So diversity in leadership is obviously an important reflection of diversity at that working level where we're planning and defining and deciding what needs to happen. And they have the ability to actually enact those well-considered recommendations, you know, from a team that's promoting them up. And at the same time, really would like those leaders to think about engendering a sense that discussions around diversity aren't necessarily about categorizing and dealing with each category one at a time, but considering that everybody has some interest in each of the needs of all of those groups, and everyone should benefit from whatever it is that we implement, and often will.
Finally, I just loved that. There was something there. You talked about people with prams, and gee, I'm seeing that with some friends who recently had babies. It's amazing the impact accessibility of the network has on their ability to get around. Thank you so much. I've just got one last question, and perhaps you might give us the kind of 60-second kind of thoughts you have. It's always a question I end on. What is your top piece of advice for women who are early on in their careers in public transport and mobility?
It's a simple one. If you can, travel. Travel every chance you get. And when you do travel, travel like you're a local. Don't take an Uber or a taxi from the airport to downtown. You know, it's a little inconvenient sometimes when you're tired and you get off a plane or whatever. You go and buy a ticket from the ticket vending machine or get the local agency's smart card and load it with some value and get the bus or the train. And remember that your experience of public transportation at home is not necessarily the experience that you'll have in other places. You're a visitor, so respect it, but take it in and observe it and have empathy for it, because what you'll bring back from, you know, actively involving yourself in every opportunity to experience different types of mobility and public transportation is you'll bring back a broader view of how your own public transportation system is performing and how it can be improved.
I love that advice. It's just amazing advice, actually. And I've never really thought about it in that way. And so I think probably really valuable for our listeners. Kylie, we're at the end. Mm. You have been amazing. I know I've thrown so many questions at you, and I just want to really recognize I can hear the consideration and experience, and you've been absolutely so generous with your thoughts and views that you've shared with our listeners today. So I just want to say a big thank you. This has definitely been a highlight episode for me in interviewing you. So really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Michelle. That's such kind words, and I've really appreciated the opportunity to share my thoughts. So thank you.
That was Kylie Gorham, Senior Product Manager at NEC. Amazing episode, and I really look forward to sharing our guest next time. This is Michelle Batsis, your host of Women Who Move Nations.
Thank you for listening to Women Who Move Nations, the public transport podcast. We're proud to deliver this episode in partnership with NEC Smart Transport Solutions. To find out more, visit nec.com.au. This series is produced by Jamie Lee Owen and Sophia Dickinson for the Public Transport Association Australia, New Zealand. To find out more, please visit our website, ptaanz.org. Tune in for more soon.